you know, usually buy Canon cameras, but excellent camera. I'd buy another one in a heartbeat.
I wonder if you got any further questions on this one, Eric. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I think I found it. It's a EX F825 high-speed compact camera with GPS. It's interesting. I've not seen one of these before. Let me look into it a little more.
Out of curiosity, Eric, you about to go out and buy a camera?
Why would I do that? I have a lot of HD cameras. I've got slow-mo cameras. I've got... You have dome cameras there. Yeah, no need, but, you know, to be aware of something that does high speed, could go back a couple of years, and, you know, when you teach a sports event, you're looking at a $120,000 camera doing the slow-mos for them. So I'm curious as to what the recording format is and how you look at it, whether you're using Final Cut or some other method, because when you're doing high speed like that, it's a 10 megapixel camera, and it does HD, and high speed capture. The place back at 30 I is 60 feet. Okay, so you can use just about anything for it. It's a matter of counting frames. Get your IWK, could you?
As you go further with that research you've started, Don, with your camera, let us know what you discover. And Eric, I got a question for you. At many of these sporting events, football games, soccer games, and whatever, there's something that I call the spider cam. In other words, it really is a set of wires way up in the bleachers or up on the roof of the stadium, and these wires go across the stadium, and now they're servo-controlled, a camera hangs from the middle, the camera is battery-operated with a radio transmitter on it, a very expensive camera that can be pan, tilted, zoomed, slow-mo, fast-mo, and whatever. So this camera goes whipping across the field at various altitudes, at various positions, so it's like a miniature helicopter, if you know what I mean. It's really watching the sporting event from all kinds of crazy angles. That's the way modern broadcast sporting events are being done these days. I wonder, have you been involved in any of those operations of those kind of broadcast cameras, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RW, K2EJ. Not working for WNET and working for companies like All Mobile and NET, yeah. There's actually a variety of different models, and they have these little guy wires that literally run from the lights on the top of the stadium to the lights on the other side of the stadium. And these cameras, they started off using little lipstick cameras, little lightweight cameras, and as there's a couple of companies that actually custom modify small high-def video cameras to sit on these wired platforms, which they are. It's sort of like a tram, so to speak. Except the wire doesn't move, there's motors on the platform which the camera is used. And they basically use a high-def graphic camera, which they weigh about a pound and a half, 2 pounds, they're not that heavy. So, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but on a really windy day, sometimes the shot shakes a little bit because the camera's blowing in the wind. But yeah, they've been doing that for a while. And the really interesting thing about sporting events, depending upon whether you're in New York, you're watching in Chicago, you'll actually see different ads on the same picture. By the same token, you can see on a football game where they'll light up the playing field showing you where the next down is, which is done electronically. It's actually done with a silicon graphics computer. It used to be what they call an oxygen computer. Very fast, MIPS, wrist type computers that do that kind of graphics overlay.
Check in.
Check in, give me your call letters and name, sir. We'll put you on the list. K2RIW.
K2RIW in the group. This is Anthony, WW2W. I have a question. I guess make it to me. I'll I'll get around to it.
Very fine, Anthony. And you weren't part of the original list of sign-ins, so we're not going to handle you immediately. We're going to go back through our schedule. And then at the end of the schedule of the next two things are the Mel's Corner information and then Paul's NASA report. And after that, we'll pick up with your question, Anthony. One other thing I was going to mention to you, Eric, is that yeah, those cameras give you a beautiful bird's-eye view by way of the computer-generated graphics you're discussing. They'll show you where the next down is. In other words, it appears to paint things onto the field, but that's really done in video processing, not done by the camera itself before it's broadcast. Also, there's a good number of radio-controlled cameras being put on race cars these days, and so a high percentage of the race drivers will allow a camera to be installed behind their head, and now you see the scene that's whipping by at 200 miles an hour that the driver of the high-speed automobile is going. You hear the sound. You see the operation of his steering wheel. You see the shake of everything. You watch the accidents in front of him and so on. So these cameras are really getting great. I wonder if you've been involved in, well, you probably know people that are involved in some of those operations. A good buddy of mine has done some of that work, and boy, it sounds like fun at times. Over to you, Eric, for any further words on this one. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. There's a number of companies in California and New York that are involved in creating those devices. Many of them use 2 gig, some of them are on 26 gig and 23 gig. I've played with ones that's on 21 gig, and you don't see the guys on the sideline holding their dishes, pointing at the cars as they go by, but they're there. Somebody had actually tried using 900, but that didn't work out very well. The cameras that they install in the cars are really inexpensive, what they call lipstick cameras. They're small, lightweight, don't require much power. Most of them are self-contained. They hold enough battery juice for the duration of the races, and sometimes they fail. And that's a big business for a particular company, a group of companies, small group of companies that do that. And they pretty much get the contracts to do it, so even though the production company that brings the truck in and the truck folks to do their stuff, they also have to have the equipment to synchronize the stuff coming from these different places, from these different cars and stuff, to make it match into the system that they're running in their truck. So it's a little bit complicated, but it's very cool and an interesting use of security camera technology, so to speak. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, I assume that the majority of those are working on the broadcast frequencies around 2 and 3 and 4 gigahertz. The fact that some of them are on 23 and 26 gigahertz is amazing to me. I've also seen what I believe is a clear plastic film that's in front of the lens on rollers. So as dirt gets splashed up from the road and the lens would ordinarily be dirty, the dirt is really falling onto that plastic film. And then you'll see every so often somebody gives a command to the camera, which rolls the rollers and the plastic films off to one side, so the schmutz that's on the lens gets moved off to one side. I've seen that in operation. At least that's my guess as to what's taking place. I wonder if I'm close to right on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yes, you are. And you'll notice that some of them don't go exactly from left to right. They go circular, whereas they actually have a glass disc in front of it on a little motor, a little servo motor that gives it a spin. In the races, it gets kind of dirty. That's, by the way, a fairly recent development because of the problems that they've had over the years. Go ahead, Dick.
To have a roll of clear plastic film that you roll it up on one side and supply it on the other side. In theory, if you got a big enough roll, you could tolerate an awful lot of dirt being picked up from the track and an awful lot of lens cleaning operations, so to speak. A disc in front strikes me as the disc would have a finite amount of area, and you can only move the disc, one sector at a time, one-eighth of the disc, so to speak, and rotate it, and pretty soon you're going to run out of clear spot on that disc. I'm amazed that can work. Or am I misunderstanding something here, Eric? Go ahead.
No, that can work, but you also have to realize that when you're dealing with a fixed focus lens, okay, there is a certain point in that focal length where you can stick anything you want, it's out of focus and you don't see it. The only thing it does is attenuate the light. So there's a different, you know, each company has their own particular way of doing it. I'm familiar with the one that has this roll of it's not a cellophane, it's actually a Tiffin ND.01, and it comes in rolls and you can use that stuff. There have also been the ones that have the round disc in front of it. It doesn't sit in the focal plane, so they eventually, it attenuates the light, but eventually it gets dark enough that they give it a little flip. You know, there's a lot of guys out there doing a lot of different things. Actually, the folks that developed the Westcan camera, which is mounted on helicopters, they have a number of different techniques of keeping it clean. So, you know, some of these guys really get an opportunity to experiment and see what works best for them.
Fascinating. Cameras go everywhere these days. We've all seen some of these 60-minute type programs where somebody goes into an organization with a camera that's probably on the button of his shirt and gets the person to say all kinds of things, and it's being recorded, and eventually that gets played on television. Kind of fun. Okay, the next thing on our list is Mel's Corner. John, KC2WGB, is going to tell us what kind of general interest type letters he's received this week from the amateurs that don't yet have their license and they're in the process of getting their license. We try to get to them by 9 o'clock because some of these are youngsters that have to go to school tomorrow. You got it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, real quick.
Who is that real quick? Just give me your call letters and name, sir.
Sorry about that. It's Don still. You never got back to me, but real quick, just to let him know, the actual model number on the camera I was using was a Casio EX-FH100. EX-FH100. All right, that's it. I'm done. Thanks a lot, Dick. N2FLDY clear.
Very fine, Don. Glad you came back with that information. You got it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. Yep, we got a goodie here. A fellow by the name of George. I think he's an older ham. He has received a Ico 460 oscilloscope, which is a recurrent type that's not triggered. And he wants to make a modulation monitor for his 2-meter radio. And he wants to be able to make some type of an adapter he can hook to his antenna and hook this thing up to this oscilloscope. Maybe you can give him a tip on what's going to be required, how involved it is, and where he can go to get that type of information. I'll start this one off. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the best of all kinds of monitors would be the one that uses an oscilloscope, where the basic speed capability of the oscilloscope can look at the RF waveform directly. In other words, if I'm operating at a 20-meter ham band and I'm transmitting 14 megacycles, and if my oscilloscope can handle 14 megacycles, life gets very easy to do that. If the particular oscilloscope only goes to 1 megacycle, which covers essentially none of the HF ham radio bands, which means now you have to look at the envelope of the modulation, not the RF carrier itself. You can still do it, but life's going to get a little more complicated. You're a lot more familiar with equipment than I am, John. When it comes to the Ico 460, what's your guess as to its upper end of its frequency response? Do you think it can go to 10 megacycles, for instance?
No, 5 megacycles is the limit.
Okay, it goes to 5 megacycles. Now, when an oscilloscope says it goes to 5 megacycles, it usually means the frequency range at which it starts falling off about 1 dB. If I'm using an oscilloscope that can go to 5 megacycles with only 1 dB of fall off in performance, and I use it at 10 or 15 megacycles instead, I'm going to get a lot less performance. In other words, I'm not going to get anywhere near as much gain. The signal will be a little bit smaller on the screen, so to speak, but still, it most likely will display the signal. So, if you can force the oscilloscope to work at your operating frequency. Even at 5 megs, he could run the experiment at 80 meters. And then depending on how well it works at 80 meters, he can decide how well he can use it at 40 meters and 20 meters and so on. Here's what I'm about to suggest. Let me drop. Almost any of the transmitters we use, if you're a QRP operator, you're putting out 5 watts. If you're a typical HF guy, you're using a rig with 100 watts. The signal you're putting out to that antenna, by oscilloscope standards, is a whopping big signal. If you poured that signal directly into the oscilloscope front end, you'd be burning it out. So you're going to be using some kind of a power sampling circuit where you're going to be taking a very small sample of what's going on with the transmitter. There's a zillion ways you can do that. One way to do it would be at the transmitter itself, install a separate, BNC connector somewhere in the back panel, and from that BNC connector, you put some kind of a sampling circuit over to the RF output. Somewhere in the back panel there is a connector, probably a UHF connector, which is the real transmitter output. And you need a very small sample of that signal. You can do it with a resistor divider network. In other words, maybe it is a 100K resistor in series with a 10K resistor going to ground, and the junction of the two goes over to your new BNC connector that's the sampling port. That's if you did it resistively. You can also do it with a sampling capacitor, a couple of picofarad capacitor over to the main transmitter output connector. As you can tell, your problem is that the signal you're looking for is too big. You have to cut it way back. There are ways of cutting it back with an extremely high impedance resistive circuit. That would give you a little bit of insertion loss. You have to worry about the power dissipation of those resistors, but you choose them big enough, and that problem almost goes away. If you use a sampling capacitor network, you can now do it in a lossless manner. Nothing gets hot, if you know what I mean. But you're looking for 1/10th or 1/100th of the voltage. Knowing your volts per centimeter on your oscilloscope allows you to know how many volts of signal you're trying to put into the oscilloscope. Knowing how many watts comes out of the
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Knowing how many watts comes out of the transmitter, and knowing that power is E squared over R, and if you solve it for E, power is E squared over R, E equals the square root of P times R. So you take the power, 100 watts, you take the resistance times 50 ohms, you multiply the two together, you take the square root, that is the RMS voltage that is present on the output of your transmitter for that power level for a 50 ohm resistive output connector. And know that is RMS, the real voltage peak, which is what you're going to see on the oscilloscope, is square root of 2 bigger than that. 1.414 times bigger is the peak voltage, and the oscilloscope is going to see the positive peak and the negative peak, so it's really 2 times that. So in other words, when you calculate E equals square root of P times R, power times 50 ohms, and take the square root, and then multiply that times 2 times the square root of 2. That tells you the peak-to-peak voltage that you're going to see on the oscilloscope. On top of that, the oscilloscope, maybe you own a 10-to-1 probe on the oscilloscope, and that makes life a little bit easier. So calculating the divide ratio you need so that you don't overpower the oscilloscope, that's a fairly simple function once you discover that the zillions of ways of making a voltage divider network or a power sampling network, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. That's the first half of the problem. That's three-quarters of the problem. Properly adjusting the amount of signal level that goes into the oscilloscope. And to look at the waveform directly is the nicest way to do it, because now you get all kinds of analysis techniques, if you know what I mean. Now to set the horizontal sweep of the oscilloscope, there's multiple ways you can do that. You can allow the horizontal sweep to free run, and you can synchronize it to the modulation. There's various ways you can synchronize the scope thoroughly externally. That's one approach. The more sophisticated approach, the Cadillac approach, would be to take the audio output of the transmitter. A second connector is sampling the audio from the microphone circuit. And if now a sample of the audio of the microphone circuit comes out a second connector that you install on your transmitter, and that goes to the horizontal circuit of the oscilloscope. In other words, you put the oscilloscope into the external horizontal mode, and if now the direct audio coming out of the transmitter, properly adjusted again with amplitude, goes into the oscilloscope as the horizontal deflection, you will now get a beautiful, what they call, butterfly display. In other words, the butterfly display looks like a large deflection to the left, zero deflection in the center, large deflection to the right, up and down deflection I'm talking about. You'll see a triangle, you'll see a double triangle across the oscilloscope screen where the tips of the two triangles are touching each other, the sharp points are touching in the middle. That is what a single sideband transmission will look like on an oscilloscope. And there's ways you could rectify the audio and make it into a single triangle, a so-called trapezoid test. But with that double triangle test, you will now see immediately whether or not the transmitter is flat-topping when you overdrive it, whether or not it's got crossover distortion, whether or not the lines are straight along the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Whether or not the lines are straight along the edge, which shows you linearity. So with that display, you'll be seeing an equivalent of the instantaneous peak RF voltage of the transmitter, whether or not any kind of nonlinearity of crossover distortion, intermodulation distortion, flat topping. That display, properly analyzed, will tell you everything you want to know about that transmitter. And so building these sampling circuits, it's a lot simpler than you think. It's just that we're not familiar with it. We don't do it every day, if you know what I mean. And he's allowed to come back and ask that question three more times if the first time he sets it up doesn't quite give him the response that he wants. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW. I wonder if you've ever done anything like that, John.
Who are you, Dick?
Yes, I have, Dick. And the only thing I was going to recommend, other than your suggestions, I believe the 460, if he takes the case off, he's able to get directly at the plate connections, which may be more of an advantage to him. That's the way I did it. But I don't know how much technical expertise he has. So back to you, Dick. Pick up Rich.
Yeah, in the early days, the oscilloscopes had an audio amplifier circuit that went from the front panel to the vertical deflection plates. And that audio amplifier circuit was the main limitation, frequency limitation. An oscilloscope that goes to 5 megacycles, it's because the audio amplifier only went to 5 megacycles. And if you drive the horizontal and vertical plates directly on the cathode ray tube of the oscilloscope, you could easily get response to 30 and 50 megacycles if you're smart enough to do that. I'd go a little bit slow on that one, though, John. You're fairly familiar with instrumentation. You worked with it for 40 years, 35 years at least. For a guy to open up the cage on an oscilloscope, which has got 5,000 volts on the cathode, and or the anode, in other words, you got some high voltages involved, you got to be careful. So once you climb in there directly, bypassing the circuitry and making sure that everything is safe as far as high voltage and grounding and whatever is concerned, you got to go a little bit slow on that one. Let's see how Rich solved that problem. I bet you've got a monitor. There's lots of commercial circuits you can buy to do this. But doing it right at the transmitter is the nicest way. You could also do it with a small pickup antenna in the shack that's really listening to the signal you're transmitting. But that's a more difficult approach. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, the K2RIW Technic Limelock N2EO. So right now I'm using a restored Heathkit SB610, which you can get them on eBay for $100 and something, maybe $150 at the most. But I'll give an idea how to make a cheap and dirty wine sampler so he doesn't have to put a jack on the radio. I did this years ago. What you do is you take a mini box, and on each end of the mini box you put a SO239 connector. If you want to make it nice, you use, I forget the UG number on it, one of these hoods. And you take a piece of coaxial cable, like RG8, and then it'll be set. About the length in a mini box, say 2 inches, 3 inches long, you strip off the black outer jacket. So you've got the inner jacket, and you've got the exposed shield of the cable. And you just solder it between the two connectors and solder the shield down to the hood. So, you know, you got a good connection there so you don't introduce a peepers pump. And then what you do is you take a piece of wire, insulated wire, maybe about a number 20 gauge, and you just pierce it under the shield of the cable. So the wire is going the length of the cable, and it's sandwiched below the shield, but insulated from the center conductor, so it's sort of in between the two. Take that wire, come out and run it to a variable, like a Johnson capacitor, variable capacitor mounted on the box, and the output of the capacitor will be a BMC connector. Now you got a line sampler, and as you adjust that capacitor, you're changing the coupling, you can get almost any amount of coupling out you want, continuously variable. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, Technet Weimark, N2EO.
I like that approach, Rich. What's nice about Rich's approach is that he's not modifying the transmitter. If it's a classic transmitter, like a Collins rig, and Rich is going to eventually buy it some number of years downrange, the fact that it hasn't been modified will increase its value. With that external rig that's put into the coaxial cable coming out of the rig, he now has the option of using the sampling circuit on all the transmitters he owns, one at a time, if you know what I mean. So it's now a thoroughly portable thing. And what Rich is saying is that inside that mini box, where you've got this piece of RG8 light coax cable, or it could be a piece of RG58, going in between the connectors, by way of the hoods on the connectors, you can make a nice shielded connection inside the box as far as the shield of the coax is concerned. And now he is snaking under the shield a enameled piece of wire. Make sure that the enamel doesn't get scraped and doesn't get shorted to the shield. So this insulated enameled wire, you have threaded it underneath the braid of the outer layer of the coax cable going between the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the mini box. And now, that is a kind of directional coupler. Let me drop. That directional coupler is sampling some of the signal. It's really sampling a combination of the magnetic field and the electrostatic field that's inside of the coax cable, because the enameled wire is on the inside, even though it's only a thousandth of an inch away from the inside layer of the shield, because it's insulated from it. The two ends of that wire, if you properly terminated one end, the other end would be a directional coupler, where you could literally make a standing wave ratio meter out of that. There, if you look at the right article in the amateur radio handbook on directional couplers, standing wave ratio meters, it's probably in the antenna book, yes, in the ARRO antenna book, you'll definitely see a couple of articles on how to build a standing wave ratio meter. A standing wave ratio meter is really a directional coupler. And by the way you look at the signal on the left-hand end and the right-hand end of the piece of enameled wire that is snaked underneath that coax cable, by properly terminating and looking at one end and then the other end, you can measure forward power, which we call calibrate, reverse power, which we call standing wave ratio. So your sampling circuit in the mini box could be an oscilloscope sampling circuit simultaneous with being a standing wave ratio meter that you are building for your particular ham rig, and you can plug it into each one of the rigs one at a time, if you know what I mean. So once you understand the principle, you can have a lot of fun with this. So Rich is on to something good here. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, that's an excellent idea, because that's something that's transportable. Go from rig to rig with it. Very good. Well, I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun, because that scope is a good little scope, recurrent, very old, but it should work well for him. But at least he has a way to start. He did try to research and look in the ham radio book and also online. He couldn't find anything that would lead him in the right direction. But got one more if you're ready, Dick.
Fire when ready, John. And you can have two more if you like.
Okay, have a young guy named Bill. He's also from Queens. He's looking to build a field strength meter. And what he has in his possession is he has a very inexpensive Radio Shack SWR meter. It has a nice little meter on it, and he wants to modify it. He has a few diodes and things like that, but he would like to know where he could go for construction information, or maybe you could help him out, just a simple explanation of what he could do to play with this. He's going to put just a little telescoping antenna on top, and he just wants to look at near fields and stuff like that to check basic outputs. So he needs a field strength meter.
And let me run this by one more time. I think he's starting off with a inline standing wave ratio meter, and he wants to modify it so that it is a local field strength meter. Do I have that correct, John? Go ahead.
Yes, you do, Dick. It has a normal PL259 in and out, SO239 in and out, and the basic instruction for an SWR bridge. He's going to take it all apart and just use the meter and whatever he needs to connect an antenna to this thing.
Been there, done that, and my goodness, was I disappointed. It turns out the standing wave ratio bridge, which normally goes inline, of, say, a 100-watt transmitter, just like this piece of enameled wire going under the coax cable for a couple of inches that we just described in the previous article, there the signal coming right out of the transmitter is a potent signal. Hundreds of volts, if you know what I mean, of RF energy, and you have to take an extremely small sample of that in order to operate a standing wave ratio bridge. The standing wave ratio bridge itself, if you were operating it now by picking up as a field strength meter, if it was picking up a signal from a second dipole, let's assume that your first dipole in the air is 132 feet long, it's an 80-meter dipole, and 50 feet away from it, broadside, you've got a second 80-meter dipole, and you're feeding that second 80-meter dipole into this Vizwar bridge. Yes, that would make a beautiful field strength meter. That's not the convenient way we want to do it. When you build a field strength meter, you'd like to have a small whip antenna on this little box. The whip antenna maybe is going to sit 6 inches or a foot high when it's expanded. You want to take a sample of the signal being radiated by the real transmitting antenna and operate the meter and watch the meter go up and down as you drive the transmitter harder and softer and as you press down the key. Because the little whip antenna that we're talking about now is so extremely small, unless you very carefully tune it, it is picking up a signal that's 30 decibels depressed, 30 decibels weaker than the real world. In other words, 30 decibels is a 1,000-to-1 power ratio. If you're running 100 milliwatts, 30 dB down for 100 watts, 30 dB down is only 100 milliwatts, you're going to get, I'm wrong with the 30 dB, it's probably more like 60 dB. You're going to pick up an extreme...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
With a simple whip antenna on this field strength meter, you're going to pick up an extremely small amount of signal. For it to be convenient, you're going to have to need a stage of gain. Your standing wave ratio meter needed a stage of loss. In other words, the signal it's picking up directly from the coax cable is such a potent signal, it had an attenuator. You've now got the opposite problem. To use a reasonable-sized whip on this field strength meter, I think it's going to take a stage of gain. I built one of these circuits. I remember standing directly under a guy's 80-meter dipole while he was transmitting 100 watts key down, and I could barely get any meter movement, if you know what I mean. I hadn't gone through the calculations. This was my beginning of my ham radio days way back in the early 60s, and I was getting extremely small sensitivity. So there's the biggest problem, to add a stage of gain. Now, nowadays, the stage of gain, by way of these little mini circuits, Mini Circuits sells you a whole lot of three-terminal amplifiers. I don't know what they're called. I wish I could remember the name of this thing. Anybody got the name of these little Mini Circuits three-terminal amplifiers?
MMICs.
Say that more slowly. It sounded like you said NNIC. Go ahead.
Those little 50-ohm in-and-out things, the MAR-2, MMICs.
Okay, MMIC is MMIC, microwave monolithic integrated circuit. So, MAR, yeah, MAR, I'm beginning to recognize it. So, once you start looking up MAR, and that's one of the things that Rich wants to know when he goes to the Mini Circuits catalog, MAR, and I'll bet you there's about 20 different model numbers, MAR and some number after that. Is that true, sir? Go ahead.
Yeah, they use like a... building blocks are like 902 megahertz amplifiers. You don't even have to worry about the impedance of 50 ohms in and out. Basically not transistors, but like you said, a monolithic circuit. It's like an integrated circuit.
Yeah, who am I talking to? And give me a typical model number. MAR-watt. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a the surface mount devices are really small. I have a bunch of MAR-8s. They work up to like maybe 1.5 to 2 gig. This is WW2W.
Very fine, Anthony. Okay, MAR-8 is beginning to sound familiar. So that thing goes from essentially, it's internally the thing is DC coupled. The coupling capacitors you put on the outside. My guess is that MAR-8 probably operates with the right coupling capacitor anywhere from a couple of megacycles to 1.5 gigahertz. The MAR-8 has roughly what power output and roughly how many decibels of gain, Tony? Go ahead.
These are low-level building block devices. It could be used to receive a very low-level, power output chains for recovering from a loss of mixers. You know, they're very high gain though. They could be between 20. I mean, when you go down to HF, they could be unstable. But if it weren't out for the 50 ohms in and out, but yeah, they could go between 20 to 30 dB gain, so it's a lot of gain. Two of them you have 60 dB gain, you know.
Okay, and can they put out a milliwatt? What's the approximate power output, Tony? Go ahead.
I think I saw one at about 50, maybe between 8 and maybe 15, 20 milliwatts.
Fantastic. All you need is about a milliwatt to drive a sensitive meter movement. So that MAR amplifier, and maybe two of them cascaded, and I think they're like $1.50 a piece. What's the approximate price of one of those, Tony?
Oh, I picked up a strip of 10 of them at a ham fest, and maybe $6-$7 around there. They're cheap as dirt, really, compared to what they do.
There you go. So in the modern day world, these little MAR circuits, these three terminal amplifiers made by Mini Circuits, among other companies, but Mini Circuits is maybe one of the easiest ways you can get a hold of one of those. If you've got 20 or 25 dB of gain per package, and now you use one or two of these packages, and each one of them is under $1 each, and it's a very simple circuit, a coupling capacitor in, a resistor on the output going up to the B+, and a coupling capacitor on the output, and a ground. That's the whole darn thing. And all of the elaborate, it really is a cascoded amplifier inside. If you took it apart, there's quite a bit of circuitry inside of this thing. You're getting a lot for your money. And it almost goes DC to light, if you know what I mean. So it goes from a couple of megacycles up to 1,500 megacycles, and it's got 20-25 dB of gain all the way. Now that, connected to a little whip antenna on the input, one or two stages of that thing that we just described into a crystal diode rectifier circuit, which then feeds the meter. And you probably want to put a gain control in there too, a potentiometer. And that potentiometer, there's zillions of ways you can operate that potentiometer. One of them would be to decrease the voltage that's going to the input amplifier to lower its gain would be one way to do it. It could be a shunt resistor across the input. It could be a voltage divider potentiometer taking the output of the last amplifier before it goes to the rectifier in the meter circuit. There's lots of ways you could do it, but now one simple little mini circuit box running off a 9-volt battery, or maybe a couple of flashlight batteries or a couple of fenlight cells, would give you a beautiful field strength meter. I'd like to believe that if we go to the right chapter, let me drop...
KC2QIQ, the comment deck.
Glenn recognized. I'd like to believe that if you go to the right chapter of the ARRL antenna book, this field strength meter that we're slowly describing and designing it in our heads right here, I'd like to believe that the circuit is already there. Somebody has worked out all of the details. And the guy who probably has already done that and ironed all the bugs out of it and made it work is going to be Glenn. So how did you solve this problem, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, The first time I met Dick was probably very, many, many years ago, and I believe I did get it from the AORL handbook, and it was a very, very simple circuit with the meter movement and everything else. But I think one of the things I've noticed over the years is that if this is somebody who really would like to get a hold of a nice, simple meter today, I know on eBay, for about anywhere from, like, usually a few dollars to maybe as high as $25, but I think the majority of these things go for, like, $10 on eBay. Field strength meters are really, really all over the place. And they work from, like, a simple battery that goes inside of it, and the meter's already there, and they come with little whip antennas already. But, to build one on your own, it's nice to have at least one of these ones from, like, eBay that have been pre-constructed so that you can at least see how one of these things works first before you actually are starting from scratch, I think, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So now, typical of all ham radio circuit projects, at the very beginning, you've got to make a choice. Is it something that you want to build? Is your motivation for building it because you want to have the experience, the fun, the bragging rights? Or is it that you only want the final product? You only want to be able to measure field strength, in which case you write a check and the problem goes away. So you got to make a decision. It's very similar to a guy who gets interested in astronomy. Is he going to grind his own mirror because he wants to understand the mirror grinding process for a parabolic mirror? Or does he really want to look at the stars, in which case he just goes out and buys a telescope and chooses the right one? So by going to eBay, and you get the one that's approximately $10 occasionally, it's a real field strength meter. I'm kind of curious, Glenn, how do they set the gain? Probably the potentiometer. And how do you set the frequency range? Do you adjust the whip just to the right length? Or is there a frequency dial on it? And the field strength meter that you buy from eBay, does it work on 80 through 10 meters? Give us a couple of words on that, then, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
There are at least ones that I used that were like in the $10 vanilla area, were like the old Radio Shack or the Lafayette ones, which were very, very similar in design. And basically, they'll operate well into 2 meters. I think that, if you try to use it on 70 centimeters, they'll fall off a little bit. But basically, they come with a little whip antenna on the output. Well, they work on 80 meters, and they're all low frequency, very, very, you just really have to attenuate the gain a little bit. So they take it takes a little bit of experimenting to work with, to see how much gain it and where to set that potentiometer with the little whip antenna on it, to see a measurement and then move it around to see where the strong fields, weak fields are. I love using them in the shack just to see if there's anything leaking around, walk around the shack with it, but they do work up into about 2 meters, Dick, and for a relatively inexpensive device. And I remember the first one that I had built, just using a simple 2N2222, that worked very, very well, almost up into definitely up to 2 meters. That's almost a little miniature VHF transistor in itself. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, when it comes to studying what radio does and how it works, once you've got a field strength meter in your hand, picture a little box with a meter on it and a whip antenna coming out of the top, internal battery, you've got it turned on, and the meter is at 3/4 scale. And now, as you rotate this machine in your hand, you've got this box with the whip antenna. As you set the whip antenna vertical, horizontal, toward you, away from you, you're probing the polarity of the E-field transmitted by your antenna. So as you move this thing around in three-dimensional space, by translating it, rotating it, and tilting it, you've got the 6 degrees of freedom here. As you move those degrees of freedom, you can probe the field. You can find out that, hey, where I'm standing in the backyard, this is primarily a horizontally polarized field, because I know when I rotate the field strength meter with the whip vertical, the signal goes into a null. And now I hold it horizontal, and I start walking around the yard, and I find the places where the signal is stronger and weaker. You're now looking at the multipath characteristics. Some of the signal is reflecting off of the aluminum siding of your house, and as you approach the aluminum siding, you'll watch the signal go up and down, particularly on the higher VHF frequencies. Because the wavelength on 80 meters is 250 feet, you've got to move quite a number of feet before you go from a peak to a valley on 80 meters. On 10 meters, now where the wavelength is 30 feet, it'll happen a lot faster. On 6 meters and 2 meters, faster yet. So you can literally, let me drop. You can have a lot of fun probing the field from your antennas. Where is it maximum? Where is it minimum? In location. Where is it maximum and minimum? In polarization. Horizontal versus vertical, a slant 45 degrees, and so on. Do the same thing inside of your house. Because your house, to you, is a wooden structure with a bunch of furniture inside. In reality, it's got conduit for the 110-volt wiring. It's got plumbing. It's got all kinds of things. If your eyes were X-ray eyes operating at radio frequencies, you live inside of a set of monkey bars, if you know what I mean. There's all kinds of metallic radio-reflecting objects, file cabinets and so on, inside your house. So once you've got this field strength meter and you start walking around with it, you can have a lot of fun with it. You only got a little hint of that when you were using your handy-talkie with the rubber duck. Let me drop. In the case of the handy-talkie with the rubber duck, there are certain places and certain ways you hold it where the repeater you're listening to 20 miles away goes into a fade, and you hear a noise in the background, or the squelch takes over and the audio disappears. You get a go-no-go situation, which is a little bit coarse. With a real field strength meter where you can quantitatively watch the meter move as you change location and orientation, it's a real fun thing to study the way radio works. But all of a sudden it'll become very clear, if I did that in my bathroom, as to why I always have to put the handy-talkie on the wooden shelf in front of the mirror horizontal. I lay it horizontal, even though I'm listening to vertically polarized repeater transmitters like the 146.85. By the time that signal reflects off all the jazz that's in my house, the majority of that signal in my bathroom is a horizontally polarized signal. The field strength meter would let you see that real fast. That's a fun tool. KC2 WGB, K2 RIW. Go ahead, John.
Well, like you said, Dick, I tried the same thing with an SWR bridge back in the day, and it was not successful at all. It was very disappointing. First of all, the meter sensitivity was yucky. Those are brute meters. You need something 50 microamperes or 100 microamperes, and then you can start building a few coils and a diode, and you will get results without any amplification. But in mine, I wound up using two NPN transistors and a little battery, just like you suggested. And then I developed a little tuning capacitor for it, and it worked very well. So I don't think you'll have much success with that, because the meter just is not sensitive enough without some amplification. That's about it from the Mel's Corner here tonight, Dick. Back to you, sir.
And just so everybody knows, I think they're in the process of setting up the website at limarc.org. Maybe it's already set up, and maybe it's not. I went and looked on their website, and I had trouble finding where I would go to give them information. So right now, for the time being, one of the ways of talking directly to Mel's Corner is to talk to you. And that address of yours, I have it here somewhere. I can't find it right now. Tell us your email address, Rich. Here we go. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Juliet Baker 5 Oscar at AOL.com.
Okay. Juliet Bravo 5. That's his initials, John, with B for his last name. Juliet Baker 5. Not 00. Juliet Baker 5 Oscar dot. At Amazon.com.
AOL.com.
How are we going to correct myself? At AOL.com. Okay. That's how you talk to John and ask him questions that are going to be added to Mel's Corner. Okay. Just those two for tonight. That's good. Now we go over to Paul. WS2N. What is NASA doing these days? And let me think now. There was something I heard of this week that was very exciting. I don't remember it right now. Hopefully I'll think of it while you're talking. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul, with the space report.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, there's not much this evening, but a couple of things I wanted to bring up. We know Curiosity is on the way to Mars, but there's another one that's being built and going to be launched next year called MAVEN, M-A-V-E-N. One of those acronyms, Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evaluation basically it's going to study the upper atmosphere of Mars. So it's an orbital spacecraft. Of course, a half a billion dollars, $400 million thing. It's well into construction. It's about a, oh, I don't know, maybe a 7 foot by 7 foot by 7 foot if you were to design the body of it like a cube, you know. And then it's got a couple of solar panels coming out. And this thing's going to be in a highly elliptical orbit, and then it's going to stay that way and operate for about a year, one Earth year, not a Mars year. So it's not a long-term mission by the spacecraft, but something to watch for. I'll have to study the science behind it a little bit more, look through it. I roughly got an idea of the upper atmosphere, and I haven't looked at the equipment on board that it's going to detect everything, but it's going to work in conjunction with Curiosity, which will be already up on the surface of Mars at the time when it gets there. WS2N. And so it will be launched by an Atlas V rocket, similar to what launched New Horizon. Well, that was the same rocket, but that one had a bunch of solids attached to it. This one's not going to need that. It's not going to have five solids attached to it like New Horizon did. But it will be an Atlas V rocket that will take it to Mars. So that'll be launched next year. And that's pretty much it on MAVEN. Let me drop it. I just want to bring up Voyager one more time that made it to the NASA site, because they've decided to shut down, that is Voyager 1, they've decided to shut down one of the heaters to save power. Right now it was really good up until 2020. Now this year they had about five more years, 2025, they'll be able to hear from this thing. So, you know, they've shut systems down before on this thing, you know, different heaters. And this thing, it's, you know, they've got like 11 different instruments attached. This one's attached to the ultraviolet spectrometer, which they pretty much don't need that much anymore, but it still operates. But they shut the heaters down, and it's still working. I mean, this thing was designed to be minus 30 Fahrenheit. And now they've gone down another 40 degrees from where it was operating, and now it's down to minus 110 and still working. So it's a well-built piece of equipment. Let me drop it. Anybody that listens to the net, we talk about the Voyagers quite a bit. It's the Voyagers and the Pioneer spacecraft that are going out to the stars. They're the four spacecraft that we've launched that will not come back. You know, what goes up comes down. Well, these things are not coming back. So for those of you who don't know, it's the Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11, Voyager 1, and Voyager 2. And they are out there. So there's a new one to join it. You know, right now, New Horizons will follow suit. That'll be one that won't come back as well. I think that's a little past halfway to Pluto. Pluto's around 39, 40 AU. I think New Horizons up to 22 now, a little over that. So back to you, Dick. That's all I had. I wanted to bring it up. We don't have much of the manned program. We have six people on board the space station, but as these new spacecraft come out. As these new spacecraft come out, we'll talk about them, be it government or commercial or even the foreign ones. We'll discuss them all. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
I think the Voyager spacecraft was launched something like 1975, about 35, 36 years ago. I believe it's now out there at a distance of something like 80 astronomical units. You're going to correct me on this one. Pluto is 39 astronomical units. So in other words, this thing is two and a half times further away from the Sun than Pluto, really out there. You're going to correct me on this one. And I believe one of the things they're looking for is, where does it run out of the solar wind? In other words, where does the solar wind stop and the interplanetary wind start taking over? That's the end of this solar system as far as the fields and waves that it issues. So how many astronomical units out there, and have they detected the edge of our solar system yet by way of the solar wind dying off and the intergalactic wind taking over? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it's into the heliopause now. I think that comes first, and then there's the another one, another barrier right after that. They probably hasn't gotten to yet, which is really the area where the solar winds lose their effect from the sun, and you wind up actually being hit by galactic winds. That becomes the stronger of the two. So, you asked the dates. Yeah, well, the best thing to do is, you probably remember this one, or write it down. If you go to heavensabove.com/solar-escape.asp, I'll repeat that later if you want, but if you go to that website, they always have the five, well, they used to have four, now they have five, because it's New Horizons. They'll have the distance, in AU, astronomical units. For people listening that don't know, there's distance between the Sun and the Earth. That would be one AU, the average distance. So when we talk about Mars being 1.6 AU, that gives you an idea. Pluto is out of 39. Well, when you get into the other ones, Pioneer 11, that's at 84 AU, 84 times the distance. Pioneer 10 is 105. And then you get to Voyager 2, drop it. Voyager 2 is 97 AU, and Voyager 1 is the big time one, that's 119 AU. And that's much further. You know, that took a little different course when they passed the Saturn. They decided that they needed a close view of Titan, the moon, so they made sure Voyager 1 would do that, and Voyager 2 just went on to the outer planets, Uranus and Neptune. So if you look at a map, it looks like all the planets, including Pluto, would be jammed in, let's say, the size of a dime. And if you look at where Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are now, they're like, I don't know, four or five times the distance of that distance. It's visually amazing how weird these things are. And Voyager 2 is on the ecliptic, where Voyager 1 is going up like 30 degrees above the ecliptic, so it looks back. That's the one that looked back and took pictures of all the planets many years ago in the solar system, all one shot. You drop it. That's pretty much it. And then, so all the planets have been visited. I mean, even Mercury now, we have a spacecraft orbiting that one called Messenger. So everyone has been visited, and of course, one left to go, Pluto. Most people say it's not a planet. I still say it is, and so I'll never give up on that one. But New Horizon, when it left, it was a planet, and then they downgraded it, but it will visit it. It won't orbit it, and then after that, it will go on to visiting the other Kuiper Belt objects past Pluto. So that's it, Dick. Back to you.
One of the really big, really beautiful spacecraft that's in the process of being built is the James Webb Space Telescope. this thing is something like, when it's all unfolded, something like 80 feet front to back, 50 feet left to right, 45 feet high with a, what is it, a 16-foot diameter mirror on it, really big infrared telescope that's going to be launched in a couple of years. And so the beautiful picture